Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. My name is Paul David. As always, I am your co-host. And without my other co-host, William Gatsby-Pete today, he's behind the scenes producing for us. We're very excited to have an incredible guest with us today, Mandana, co-founder and CEO at Lena. Welcome to the show, Mandana.
Thank you very much, Paul and Will, for having me on the show.
It's great to have you on. And maybe just give our audience a quick overview of your work at Alina. What are y'all up to over there?
So Alina is a digital mental health solution where we are trying to bring cutting-edge technology to people's doorsteps. And what we are doing is solving the treatment assignment problem. What we mean by that is when people are feeling unwell, they're not looking for labels and they're not looking for the most advanced treatment or things that are out there, but they say, I'm unwell. What is the fastest way of me getting better? This is what we are trying to do. We keep all the tech, science, and everything behind the doors, and they come in onto our platform. They play a game or two or three. We do this analysis on the back end, and we just tell them, you know what? This is how your brain works in these situations. It's a bonus. It's great in these situations. It might hurt you, and maybe that's why you're here. And this is the solution for you to get better. And as simple as that.
That's great. That's a great overview. Yeah, we ran into Alina before. I think it was under a different name, and you guys have had a great rebrand. So very excited to see that as content marketers ourselves. So how's that going so far?
That's good. I mean, the whole rebranding, it has quite a story of its own. And this also shows the struggles that you have as an early stage startup, where you have a vision and you want to bring, and I believe in tech for good, and you are trying to bring that to people and help them with their lives and everything. But then at the beginning, they're also admins when there are other entities at play where they're established and they just don't want competition. And this is the thing we faced. We had one of the big companies coming at us with our earlier names and our earlier brand. It's like, oh, you know, you're too similar. We just thought, you know what? We don't want to fight with you. Just we are busy building actual things. And that's how we rebranded to Alina. And I'm actually happy it was for the better.
Very cool. And what's the name Alina, if you could explain to our audience, like what does it mean, or how'd you come about it?
Alina is a derivative from Helena, which means a shining light. And this is what we're hoping for it to be in people's lives.
That's amazing. I have an ex-partner named Helena, so I'll never forget your name now, because it just ties me back to that. Just jumping into the articles as we do on Tech Can't Save Us, we like to talk about some topical pieces relevant to our guest experience. And one of the first pieces we share with you is from MedCity News, just about sort of, you know, what's working, what's not working in mental health and tech and mental health specifically. One of the things that the article mentions that is working is sort of personalization of treatment plans. And that's not something that's, you know, quite specific to what you're doing. It seems like you're deeply personalizing treatment for, you know, the users of your platform. So curious to hear your perspective on what you see is working, not working in tech and mental health, personalization. What's your perspective?
Yes, I think the future for mental health, and not just mental health, any kinds of medicine or healthcare that we can think of, personalization is the key, because at the end of the day, what matters is what's happening to me, my body, my brain, my life. Therefore, it has to be specific to me, my body, my life, my brain. So far, the way mental health has been going is, I say, is like similar to how physical health was 200 years ago. Where people go see a therapist, they exhibit symptoms. Say 200 years ago, it was, oh, I have fever. And they would say, oh, try this potion and that, because it often works. And there's no guarantee it works, but we won't know until you try it. And then they would go, you know, cycle through these different treatments. And it was at the mercy of the physician to sort of observe what's happening to the patient, to just sort of like adjust the course of treatment. Unfortunately, this is the current state of mental health. We know therapists don't have the equipments or access to actually measure specific things about the brain, which is where, you know, mental health actually resides. You go there, you talk about your symptoms, you talk about your problems, and then depending on how good they are, they're able to go through this whole Socratic questioning of finding the right treatment for you. You experiencing through them, if you're lucky at some point, one of them working for you. For that reason, I truly believe without technology, we cannot get to the point where we should be, where we had technology to bring physical health to where it is. We have blood testing capabilities. We have machines that look at our bones. We allowed technology to lend a hand there to us. And it helps specialists to make an educated guess based on the cause of a symptom, what would be the right treatment. And this is where I think when we talk about personalization in mental health, this is exactly what we should be looking at. We should look at finding out what are the causes of the symptoms people report and then give them treatment based on an assessment of those causes. Unfortunately, when you hear in the tech world about personalization, this is not everybody's view. People have different definitions of what personalization means to them. Often the case, I guess, it comes from their field, their background, their views on data and how that works. Yeah, so I have quite strong feelings when it comes to that, while I believe that's the future.
Yeah, how would you say, what's your unique perspective on personalization? What are you bringing to the field, would you say?
So what we are bringing to the field is literally measuring individual persons' cognitive functions and understanding them as they are. This is what I define as personalization. It's like looking at a person as an individual and just dealing with that.
Seems quite personal.
Exactly. And I think that's what personalization should be. But that is not how it's being used often. Sometimes the easiest, well, it's not really easy because it is still technologically challenging. It's a data problem. Is where people say, oh, let's look at populations. And then we try to find out which population you're closest to. And then we personalize treatment based on which population you identify with. Yes, it is personalization compared to just being given a random treatment and hope for it to work. But it is not true personalization. It is still like measuring you with respect to a population. They don't measure you with respect to who you are.
And do you run into sort of privacy issues at Azure in the pursuit of personalization? Like how do you deal with those specifically?
So we have this strong stance that data is the person's property. For that reason, we take it very, very seriously, the whole privacy issues. So if we ever use data to do research or understand, because this is R&D, you need people's data, it is always explicitly stated and we get consent from people. And if they withdraw consent, immediately everything gets either deleted or is returned back to them. One thing we do believe is that hopefully globally we move towards a place where we realize we depend on each other. So if I am asking for cutting edge science come to my service, I need to help that science get there where it can help me and others. If you're trying to understand the human brain, if you're trying to understand mental health, we need to allow and be a part of it, have a voice in there. And sometimes for that reason, I am thankful to people who allow us to use their anonymized data. We do not use, there is nothing labeled with there. I am thankful to them. And we always consider that a contribution to science. And that is their way of making the world a better place because it makes our science stronger, helps others.
To your point about the need out there, like, you know, one of the astounding statistics from the piece was about something like 20% of people who actually need the services are able to access care. And then even among that group, you know, maybe like 50%, I think is the statistic, who access the care are actually, you know, actually get better, which is astounding. It just speaks to like the opportunity, quote unquote, in the market, but like the need out there. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
That statistic is very interesting because to think about it, why only 50% get better? The reason only 50% get better is that the treatment that is being delivered, the cause of their problem, right, where this treatment could actually address, was available or active only in that population. The other 50% where they exhibited the symptoms, they had the same, say, they had social anxiety, they had depression, exactly like fever. There are different causes for that. These are symptoms. And if the cause is very different, it doesn't matter how much of this treatment they receive, right? They won't get better. And that is why it's very important for us to start looking into modernizing mental health care system, the way we did for physical health care system, and move it to a place where we can look at the causes rather than symptoms.
That's a good segue into the second piece, which is the Wired piece about sort of like the problem with bots in healthcare. And I think there's like a nervousness when people are like, okay, maybe I have seen a therapist, maybe I had some success with it, but I'm nervous about, you know, my data being on a platform. I'm nervous about interacting with like AI or bots who maybe can't understand me the way a human, you know, could potentially. Yeah, what's your take on sort of the use of bots and AI in mental health tech?
Well, I agree with those who say bots are not the solution. I totally agree with them. People who are very excited and they think, oh, we're using this, you know, natural language processing to communicate with people and talk about the most intimate part of who they are, their identity, their brain. I think that's a bit arrogant, think of it that way. Unfortunately, too much credit is given to these bots, and they do more damage than good. It saddens me when sometimes people stand there confidently talking about the power of these algorithms. They are very limited. They usually are more like a mirror echoing how people use language. They do not have an understanding of what underpins a language. For us, language is not just a string of words we produce. We use it to communicate really, really complex emotions and concepts, where anybody who understands machine learning and AI knows that we are years, decades, maybe even a century away from understanding those things in terms of natural language processing. So I wish people were more aware, and you would think people who deploy them should have that awareness, but there we go. Sometimes business takes priority over facts and things like that. So I think that does more damage. Now, in terms of AI, I would separate that from the use of bots. AI, where it comes to understanding data and seeing patterns, it can be a powerful tool, but it's a tool. It's not a solution. What it means is that people have to be very careful. A tool can be good and it can be bad. Like, think about a knife. Is knife a good thing or is it a bad thing? In the hand of a surgeon, it saves lives because they understand how to wield it. They understand its limitation. They know how to turn it. In the hands of a murderer, it can take life. The same holds for AI. It's a tool. In the right hands, those who understand its limitations, those who understand its biases, those who understand how to use it, it can be a powerful thing. It can save lives. It can make the world a better place. But if it goes into hands of people who have too much blind belief in it or have ulterior motives, they think, oh, it's a shiny thing, I can lure people into this and that, it can do really, really bad damages.
On the AI side of things, are you all, Alina, leveraging AI in sort of the way you just suggested, to like see patterns and to, you know, like, you know, gain insights from data, or have you seen it used, you know, in the mental health tech space to great effect?
Yes, we definitely are using AI. To me, where the world currently is, if there is a tech solution that is not using machine learning and AI, 40 years ago, you needed to know coding to be able to do something that is automated, right? So it's just similar to that. It's the alphabet of the future. So of course we do use AI, but we are also very aware of its limitations. When we use it, whatever the algorithm spits out is like, all right, what was the condition? How did, because these come from an assumption from the researcher, and we take all of that into account. So we're very, very, very careful in how we interpret it, because the human mind is a very complex thing. It is one of those frontiers that we are yet to understand. We take it, we use it, we deploy it, but we are extremely careful about it.
You're obviously launching, Alina, in the midst of, like, you know, a sea change in digital health services. And it's a good segue to the third piece we shared from the New York Times about therapy for people who can't go to therapy, right? And one of the first statistics they mentioned in the article is that nearly like 40% of mental health and substance use outpatient treatments, I think this is in the States at least, are offered remotely, whereas it was just 1% in 2019. So obviously a lot of that was driven by the pandemic and the lockdowns and things like that. So I'm curious to hear your perspective about like this shift from people accessing maybe these tools and accessing care in general in person, now moving into the digital world, and where Alina sits within that kind of sea change.
Yes, pandemic accelerated this whole adoption of digital health tech. I remember we sort of started thinking about Alina before pandemic, and when we were talking to people about having this mental health solution where it measures cognitive functions and then provides specific personalized treatment to people, everybody was looking at us as if you're like, what, we're talking sci-fi. But pandemic happened. By the virtue of need, things accelerated. And now it's become like a very common understanding that it's a possibility. So of course, where Alina sits, we sit on the digital end rather than the personal end. But we don't believe digital solutions are going to be the final solution. Because again, as I said, Alina is a tool. Mental health is not a single person's journey and it's not a single person's event. Mental health exhibits itself as a person lives in society. It is our relationship with people around us. It's our relationship with our future. It's our relationship with how we view life. That's mental health. It's not, I go in, I take this medication, I go in, I do this exercise. That is not mental health. So what Alina tries to do, it is a tool that we hope for people to use to understand themselves better. And Alina helps them understand, how are they perceived in a social setting, in a world setting? How are they being understood? Their different ways of being. Where is it good? Where is it bad? because the way we look at mental health, it's a part of genetics, right? Our brain, our behavior, our emotions, it comes out of our genetic makeup. So by the virtue of evolution, there has to be diversity. Unfortunately, with advancement of technology, our environment started to become very uniform. And what that means is that this uniform environment fits some people, but it doesn't fit others. And this misfit between who we are and the environment around us then gives rise to this mental health problem. That's why as the societies and technology and life becomes more and more harmonious and in one way, gets easier. On the other hand, we have more and more mental health problems because more and more of us do not fit in this society. Yeah, this is the task Alina is taking on. Let me help you figure out who you are. And let me tell you why you're great in these situations and why you might struggle. You're not broken. It's just a misfit there. And then the rest is really about society, the person. Alina is like a tool they have to use to work on that.
That's super interesting and really resonates with me as I used to be an educator and I worked with a lot of students who were designated as, you know, special needs or special education, as we call it in the States. And I just remember thinking like, I worked in education for about a decade and I remember thinking like, we're not getting this right. Like something is wrong with the way we're stigmatizing and labeling people. And then on the back of that, the services we're delivering, you know, to kind of help. It felt like we were just putting, you know, different categories of young people and students into boxes and then not delivering, you know, exactly what they needed. And not, I ended up writing my dissertation on like learning environments. And I really like how you phrase like, you know, we've created this world partly because of technology. It's great for people who are highly literate in terms of reading and writing and certain skills that we've deemed economically relevant. But like other folks, it's terrible. You know what I mean? It's really like, it's like this bizarro world where their skills and their mindsets just don't fit. And I really love that framing and how you're kind of diving into that with Alina.
I totally agree with you. And I think it is foolish of us as a society, globally even, to think there is a certain way of being to be like be the future. Many of the people who might be struggling just because of this misfit, usually it's just one or two barriers that if we lift off, they have potentials to create amazing things to contribute to this world. And this is what I consider to be Alina's primary responsibility, to help them understand those barriers and then use maybe Alina helps them to find a way or Alina augments them. I give you an example of how this is actually being done in other digital settings. A very, very simple thing, Google Maps. There are people, just again, by the virtue of genetic variability, they cannot orient themselves. Like they get lost. They can't navigate from point A to point B. Now, if this is a person who would be, say, I don't know, a singer, a doctor, it could be education, whatever, right? Without a digital tool, which is Google Map, that tells them now go right, now go left, they will always be at the mercy of someone to walk them, chauffeur them around. So then only they can then get to the point to be able to contribute and access and tap their potentials and their abilities, the amazing things they could do. Without something like Google Map, and that is why I say tech is tool. Without something like Google Map, these people might never be able to do what they would be doing because no one can actually give up their life and chauffeur someone around, right? Unless this is a very rich person, which is the other thing. This world would only work for rich people. That is why I believe the right amount of, with the right technology, if it is used as tools to help people live their life to the points where they are great and not feel broken about the things they are not so, this world will become a better place.
Have you ever seen the movie or heard of Temple Grandin?
No.
You should check it out. I'm going to butcher maybe the backstory here, but Claire Danes does an amazing job of playing her. And she, you know, is on the, you know, spectrum and I believe is categorized as autistic. Again, another label. But the story is just about how this individual, Temple Grandin, actually thinks in shapes and her journey, her learning journey, things like that. She ended up developing kind of a new and more humane way of like sort of herding cattle because she could put herself in the shoes of, you know, the cattle. And I think one of the ways she made herself feel safe and protected when she was having kind of like an episode was she created like a device that would like hug her and like, you know, really like almost like she was in a womb or something like that. And then she created that device for cattle and rerouted the way that they were, you know, sort of pushed through, you know, say what you will about how we treat, you know, cattle and industrial farming, but it ended up being a much more effective way to, you know, cattle herd and to corral them and things like that. Again, check out the movie yourself. But part of that movie that's so powerful is just they show her learning journey, the way she thinks and shapes, the way the world just really didn't react well to it, and just sort of show like, hey, we need to figure out a way to better appreciate people who think differently in different ways and integrate them into society. And luckily for Temple Grandin, she made it through and created this amazing thing and won awards and things like that. But I think it's a great example that speaks to what you're talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, it would be incredible. We have to celebrate diversity.
Yeah.
And that does come from these people who won't fit.
Another piece in the article talks about the fundraising prospects for, you know, the digital health world. And you talk about, you know, companies providing these services. They raised over $5 billion globally in 2021 alone, which is 139% increase. So super curious to hear what you and your team at Alina are seeing in the fundraising environment, the venture capital world, and what your sort of fundraising journey has been like.
That's an interesting question. I guess it has not been a normal world for anybody the past couple of years, let's put it that way. And of course, the funding world wasn't an exception either. So we have been in some ways lucky because we are a deep science company, but with a mission for individual people. So it means the product we're producing is going to be for every single person on this planet, supported by proper science. When it comes to competition for raising funds, it puts us in a very good advantage because if you do want to change the world, it has to be on solid grounds. It cannot be on someone's hunch or a flare or a current trend or things like that. So while it was quite brutal the last year for some of our competitors to raise money, it was actually a bit of a relief for us because mental health is a very crowded space. It's a space where we all know nobody has cracked it. Nobody has found a solution to scale and truly, truly help people. And therefore, everybody wants to give it a try. And then when it became harder, convince, you know, VCs and investors and so forth to fund, they became more critical. They wouldn't just deploy funds just like that. They would now start to look, why would you be there? Because now their money, like they had to be very careful. They didn't have as much of it. So that we found that we are thriving. Because now suddenly the noise quietened a little bit. And now we could talk about why we are the ones and why this is solid, solid grounds. Show them. And at the same time, show them within this white coat experience, lab experience, sits a very, very human vision. And that's we are very centered on people. It's about people. It's not about technology. So that puts us in a very unique position. So we've been blessed.
That's great. Whenever you get asked about funding and you hear the words blessed and thriving, I mean, that's amazing. You don't always hear those. So that's really good to hear. Yeah, I remember talking to like, I think Omar, your CTO, like 2 years ago, like in the middle of the pandemic as we were launching our agency and just being like, these guys have a super cool product. Like, how do we get involved with them? I just remember, you know, seeing the writing on the wall that y'all were headed somewhere. So good to hear that it's happening.
Thank you.
Us into, you know, some of the questions that we sent over to you. And first, just to kind of back up a bit and would love to learn more about the origin story of Alina. What was sort of the process and inspiration behind creating it? And what was your ultimate goal when you started?
Alina has been my lifelong journey, I have to say. So it's going to be a very long story. I'll give you the short version of it. I was born during war. So the first 8 years of my life, war was the only thing I knew. And then one day, one of the scariest days of my life happened. I woke up. And everybody around me was happy. Trust me, that is a scary scene when suddenly like everybody's euphoric, like, you know, happy to the point of unrecognizable. And I asked what's happened and I was told war is over. So of course, I didn't know what that means. So I had to ask, what does it mean? Because it's like, oh.
How old were you at that time?
I was 8.
Okay, yeah.
Like somebody tells you, oh, sun is gone, like light is gone. What does that mean? If you've never seen night, you won't understand day, right? Because I had not seen peace, I didn't know what it means for war to be over. That being said, one thing I realized, and that was the start and the spark in my head about interest in human mind, was that I saw people, like the world around me had not changed. The buildings, the people, life, everything was the same. But this belief, this hope, that I have my life in my control. Nothing can take it away from me and I can build my future. Suddenly changed the universe around me. People started contributing. People started building. People were happy. It would do things they weren't doing before. To see that a belief, a mindset can change behavior to such a crazy degree, that was a unique observation I had at a very young age, at a national scale, let's put it that way. So it was really burnt into my mind's eye. And I was also was wanted to understand, like, how does this work? And of course, when I was little, back then, mental health was not a concept in my home country. I think right now it's just become a thing. And only through my journey of understanding was that I came to the conclusion, what I thought is a change of belief, and it's like a better mental health, is the hope, literally, and control. Throughout that, I was also studying computational neuroscience, which is an objective understanding of how the human brain works, animal brain works, where do emotions come from, where do decisions come from, where does behavior come from. And that's how the two got married. Because I thought, you know what, we have this wealth of knowledge in academia where we understand how the brain works. We have people out there, they don't know who they are. They don't have control. They don't have hope. It's just horrible. So why don't we bring that understanding in the same way as I explained to you earlier, for Alina to be a tool to provide that, to give them control back on their life so they have it in their own hands. They don't need other people to do things for them. People are enough. They just need to go over some barriers. And that is where Alina came from.
That's a powerful origin story. You should do more podcasts. I think you said you don't normally do podcasts. That's incredible. Curious to hear a bit more about that journey. Like, how did you land in the UK and why did you end up here, you know, as part of your, you know, your founder story to start Alina?
As I said, from a very young age, I wanted to understand how the brain works. And in my home country, the only way to do that was through studying pharmacology. It wasn't easy to get there. It's very competitive. The year I competed to get to the university, there was literally 1 million applicants for 300 seats. So you can imagine, it's not that easy. But I got to one of those seats. While I was doing research in brain, someone told me, do you know what computational neuroscience is? And I'm like, no. And they said, you have to, this is mathematical way of understanding the brain. This is like the objective way of understanding it. This is the true thing. And I took a 9-hour bus ride. I went to the Capitol where there were these two gentlemen who had come from, one of them from New York University, the other one from Niels Bohr Institute, to introduce this field to my country. Those 3 days, they changed my life. I was glued to my chair and I thought, this is it. This is the future. I am going to learn this subject. Pharmacology, interesting, but it's not what I think technology is going to, like, consumer-facing technology is going to be. So I spoke to one of them, the professor from Niels Bohr Institute, and I said, what do I need to do to study this field? Because back then, there was only one center that was truly teaching people, and that was Gatsby Unit at UCL in London. And he said to me, it's a PhD, it's a graduate level study. I said, okay, fine, I'm going to study that. And he said, well, wait a minute, you need to have a very strong foundation in physics and math.
You're like, I'm going to London. Where's my plane ticket? Let's go.
Then what I did, I actually switched fields. I went to the US. I started at a community college in the US because I didn't have money.
Whereabouts in the US?
Montgomery College in Rockville, Maryland.
Ah, okay. I'm from Pennsylvania, so next door, but yeah.
Next door, yeah. So I didn't have money to go to any of these fancy universities. So I could afford this community college, which was one of the best educations I ever got. I'm still in contact with them. Amazing people. I realized if you're really into science, you can actually make money being a student. I was getting scholarships, so it was good. And then I transferred to University of Maryland to finish my physics degree, which I finished. It was an honors degree. I finished it in 3 years, which again, they told me I'm crazy. Honors usually takes 5 years. What do I think? And I said to them, I don't have money.
Wow.
It has to finish fast. And I'm heading to London.
I got to get out of here. I got London's calling me. I got to. Nice.
Exactly.
Well done.
And then I got a scholarship, actually. It was a very generous scholarship from Gatsby Foundation. I landed at Gatsby and I started my PhD in computational neuroscience and machine learning. That was my dream, to study that field. And I do believe that's the future. That was the best education ever.
That's amazing. Like, as someone who wasn't, think of myself as very skilled in math and science as a young person, still not very much a writer or sort of like English social studies history vibe, but like, I'm so impressed with folks like yourself who have like deep, you know, scientific expertise. They're doctors and PhDs and stuff like that, but they're also launching businesses and product developing and stuff like that. It's just such an impressive crossover, I think, of, and it speaks to like the skill and insight you're putting into the product. Is like, look, I've studied this stuff at the best places and I'm putting all that into the product. And I'm sure it gives, you know, your users and audience like a lot of confidence in the product, knowing that you've been on this journey. So thanks for sharing that.
Thank you very much, Paul. That's very kind of you to say that. But from my perspective, I mean, I went to study those things because I wanted to make a difference. Every single piece of knowledge, and I still do that, I am hungry for knowledge because I believe change only happens if you have your feet on solid ground. And if I am going to tell people this is going to make a difference for you. I should be able to sit there on my knees, my hands muddy to elbow, and show them ground up why this is going to make a difference for them. Especially when it's about people's minds. This is the most vulnerable part of who they are. And I think it's arrogant if you go into that and you don't even know what it is you're doing. That's wrong. That's, I think, unethical.
I'm glad you said that. There's something particularly sacred about the space of digital health and digital mental health in particular, in terms of, and I'm sure there's probably, you know, a lot of like regulatory and sort of legal issues that maybe you have run into, which we can get into as we talk about the product. But super curious, it's a great segue into the product itself. Would love to just have you explain to our audience like how the product works, and sort of the follow-up question is, you know, what have been some of your favorite features with the product, or what are your team's favorite features with the products as you're explaining it?
I'm glad that you spoke of these regulatory things. I truly believe they are very important. It actually cuts through the noise, because I have to tell you a funny story, Paul. So when we started to think about Alina, and we said, well, we are proper science. We are going to be a medical device. Some investors went like, oh my gosh, you're thinking of regulating yourself? You're dead. And they backed off. And I'm like, okay, then you're the wrong partner. I don't care. We are proper. So, and why not? But everybody scared us of how tough this whole regulatory stuff is going to be. But we thought, we are the real deal. We're not scared. And while we got through this whole thing, it's so funny, because suddenly we realized the things that regulators were expecting, the regulations are expecting, we had done twice, three times more than that. For us, literally, it was a breeze. Like, we went through it. If anything, that's my stance. Like, why are they not taking this thing more seriously? Because they are, if they are putting this stamp of approval on something, people trust them. So it's very important for them to make sure. Like, for me, I'm a scientist. That's why I take really great care on the quality of our product. And regulation is about quality. It's about protecting public interest. It's protecting the person who doesn't have the knowledge to assess, is this the real deal or not? And if a regulation put their stamp on it, it means like, yes, I've checked this. They should do more, actually. When it comes to digital health, I think this is a little bit like, I've seen some people going through the space and I'm like, no, no, no. If it were me, I wouldn't let them through. But there we go.
I love that you said that too, because especially as like a scientist, a doctor, and like an entrepreneur, regulation has been kind of like undervalued by, I'll just say, our generation in general. I think like we've sort of been schooled to like, oh, just go start something new, just like, you know, start a company or like whatever, join a startup and stuff like that. We forget about like the power of regulation to really move societies forward, whether it's like workplace, things aren't going to fall on your, you know, your uncle or your auntie's head when they're working at a work site, or in medicine, you know, to prevent, you know, medical malpractice and things like that. I think that's a really important point, that like we need to like think more of regulation and as like a baseline, as a floor for our society. So really appreciate you saying that. Follow-up question, have you seen improvements in that area in terms of like, have you seen the regulators kind of step up their game in the world of digital health tech in general?
You want my honest opinion?
Yes, please.
I wouldn't say that it has improved, but I would say it has become more complicated. So I think a true improvement is where, instead of creating more forms and creating crazy complicated diagrams with a billion redundancies in it, I mean, when you look at it as an engineer or a scientist, you're like, come on, man, you just sit down. This is literally three arrows. Why is it three pages? The first thing they need to do is to understand complexity does not equate quality. And unfortunately, when it comes to regulations, I guess, I don't know why, but maybe it's because these are not scientist or engineer mindset. These are more like administrative mindset. There is a foundation, and I slap on it. It's like, you know, it's like a house of a billion builders, where it's a part of it is, you know, Victorian style. And then on top of that, you have a modern building. And then next to it is something else added on. There are a billion adds on with very little coherence between them. And they leave it to the companies and to the people to actually navigate that whole thing. And some people actually are making money out of it. But this is such a maze, it's crazy. So no, in that sense, no. To pay attention to the true thing that brings quality to people, I would say no. In fact, it's pretty thin when it comes to definition of what makes something quality. It's all definition of risk based on risk. That is not quality. That is not.
It's a big question, because it's like who washes the washers, right? That classic question, and sort of like, how are they trained? How are they developed themselves as regulators and leaders to even measure and understand these products that are coming out, and tie that to the needs in society, which I think is like a really, really, I think we have like a really impoverished continuum, you know, if you can even call it that, for training our both elected leaders and our sort of administrative and regulatory leaders. And I think that's like is really scary. And as an entrepreneur, you see the other side of that and you're like, man, like if you're doing 2 or 3x above what they're asking, then what's happening, you know, below that in terms of the products that are coming out?
I know, it is really scary. And you know, I tell you another story, Paul, and that really made me mad actually. And there was this news writer who reached out to me about a news article she had written, and she wanted my opinion. And I'm like, I'll tell you my opinion on this. So it was about a product to help with trauma. It was gamification of treatment for trauma for children. And they had deployed this in Lebanon, and they had kind of like claimed success. And this news was about how they're now going to deploy this in Ukraine. And I said to her, as a news writer, you have responsibility. You have duty of care. You cannot just excitedly report something. Or I don't know, maybe this was a paid piece. I have no idea what this was. But like trauma is a very deep thing. This is something DARPA, you know, military, those are working on it and they haven't resolved this yet with the amount of budgets they have. Now, this company deploying it on 70, 100 children, who knows what condition, what, they reported back. And now you're advocating for this to be deployed to children in Ukraine? Stop. This is wrong. Because then not only this can hurt, because who has decided this is actually working? And two, on top of that, you are going to deprive these children from true care. Because in the name of help, they are receiving help. That box is ticked. But what is happening? Like, stop it. So I think I might have been a bit hard on her, but I think in general, this is something that bothers me when I see when it comes to news, when it comes to PR and all of those things. I think people who spread and advocate and advertise, I wish people were a little bit more, like we talk about regulations and everything, but as general public, we also have that power to block nonsense. Like some things are just common sense and we should not be a part of that. So this is the thing. Like, again, there has to be regulations when it comes, say, to news. Are you allowed to start advertising or talking or promoting something that is nonsense?
It's also like, just reflect on one thing you said. It's not necessarily like being hard on people. It's just rigor, like for your profession and your industry, and saying like, look, we all have responsibility in this industry to not let, you know, standards slack and slip. So how are we going to, you know, work together to uphold them? So I feel like that's really important. And I'm glad you flagged that. With the product, I understand, you know, it's evidence-based assessments, you know, or evidence-based therapy, I should say, and neuroscience-based assessments. And I understand you have people helping you co-create, Alina, as you're gearing up for launch. So just super curious to hear about like those specific bits of the product and how they work together.
When you think of Alina, what we do is that people come onto the platform and then they play these games. These are digital like games on their smartphones. As far as they're concerned, they're just playing a normal game. But of course, we're measuring, we're assessing specific cognitive functions. These are really tested. What we call co-creators, we're asking people to join us. They come in, and that's what I said. I am thankful for them to share their anonymous data, which then we use to perfect these games so that they become proper scientific measurement tools. These are the things we used to produce in academia. Now we're producing the same thing to the same standard in industry. From that understanding, then we offer people this evidence-based, again, proven, tested treatment that will make them better. When you spoke of which feature I find exciting in Alina, the bit that I find exciting is our games. And the reason I find our games exciting is that within 10 minutes, we can understand so much about the working of that specific cognition and give it back to the person. We give them such an in-depth understanding of how they think and behave within 10 minutes. It might take 6 months of a therapy session with a good therapist for them to get to that depth. Because I am in the belief that if people have that understanding of their brain and then they are given those as a tool to give them in that rapid state in a way that doesn't depend on their command of language, because most of these other things is like, how good am I at communicating myself? How good am I at doing these questionnaires? How am I going to express myself and all of that? This is all independent of that. This is just you playing a game. I found that pretty powerful. And I think that's our signature achievement at Alina.
That's really cool. And I like the intentionality, you know, and the sort of diligence with which you're sort of rolling out the features bit by bit. And you're, you know, asking people to co-create it with you based on their experience. very much speaks to your point about personalization and how to do it, you know, in a thoughtful way, but also at scale. That's really smart. So I know you're not quite at, you know, at the point where everything's launched and out in the world yet, but any initial success stories or sort of like exciting developments from sort of the testing and building phase that you can share with our audience?
As I said, like we ask people to co-create Alena with us because we bring the science. They come and tell us what they need this science to do for them. So that's how this whole works. As you said, we've been rolling things bit by bit. There have been people who have been going through different constellations of games and therapy and, you know, all of that stuff. And I have to say majority of people, which gives us so much happiness, pride and joy. And we sometimes have this whiteboard in the office where we write their quotes when they come back. These are people, just we don't know them, right? We don't even know who they look like. Usually they use just random names. It's not even their actual names. And they tell us that you are helping me see myself in a light that I had never seen before. Like I have this deeper understanding that I didn't even think like I could have. If I were to distill all of these messages together, I believe Alena is doing something for them that we want to do, and that is to bring hope for them, to make them understand they're not broken. Being different is not the same as being broken, and you're different, and there is hope for you to know how that difference is actually a power and how to turn that into something for building your life and your future. So when they come to Alena, they feel broken, they feel powerless, they feel like, I don't know what to do with my life. They engage with us and they feel hopeful, they feel powerful. And I think that is the best, you know, the best thing we can do, the best kind of like legacy we can leave behind if Alena succeeds and we go forward, that we have people become hopeful and in control of their life. The same way, as I said, when I looked back, when I saw how a whole country started looking different, when there was this feeling of hope and control, we are doing that for people. And they tell us that.
Yeah, it's amazing, especially too, coming out of lockdowns. And I think one thing that I learned from it is just like the power of agency and people feeling like they have control of their own lives. I know for myself, what I turned to during lockdown was my mental health, my physical health. I started cooking and eating better. I just started turning towards like things that I had more control over than I thought I did. And frankly, things I wasn't controlling very well previous to the lockdown. And you know, everyone had a different experience of lockdown, obviously, but I think that's so powerful. Sort of leads me to another follow-up question is like, one of the taglines you mentioned is like training people to be their own therapist, right? So super curious to hear, have you run into any friction from the professional mental health community about, you know, that approach? And like, yeah, just curious about that bit.
So it's a funny one. I found out that we are Marmite.
I love Marmite. Tell me more.
For those people who don't know, Marmite is the spread. Some people love it. Some people hate it. There is nobody who says meh. So we are Marmite of digital health. Some healthcare professionals, they absolutely love us. They're impatient for us. They want to roll us into their kind of like clinics and all of that. And there are some who just say, what are you talking about? No, they feel threatened by just our mere existence. It's been quite a journey. I think it comes from a little bit lack of ignorance about what digital tech can actually do and cannot do. And some of these, they keep talking about how mental health is a very human thing. And they don't realize that we are in agreement with them. Mental health is the human thing, right? It's the only thing we have as humans. Because you see, this is a problem. Like some other companies that are out there and they talk about, oh, these chatbots, this is the ultimate solution. We're going to replace the therapies. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We don't make that kind of claims. We say we are building tools for you so that you understand who you are. And this is the ultimate job of a therapist, to help people understand who they are. And I think we have to respect people that they have the intelligence. Ultimately, no matter what kind of specialist you see or what kind of pills you down, it's up to you. It's up to you what happens to your life. When it comes about, we help people become their own therapist, is to give them that power to choose what they do with their lives. And one of them could be that they may decide to go and see a therapist, but it's now the other way around. It's a choice. They understand where the therapist fits in their life rather than the therapist tells them what to do with their life.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love that tagline, like the Marmite of mental health or digital health. That's awesome. You should use that in your marketing. I think that will be really powerfully accepted. But yeah, that other piece too about like, I think a lot of, you know, digital products, tech products start with this like kernel of critique of like the existing system and like what's working, what's not working. And I think that can be very confronting, you know, for the people who are operating that system, because it kind of says like, look, you're operating the system. It's not working for a lot of people. The statistics we mentioned earlier about 20% of people having access to care, 50% even getting better when they do access care. There's always that piece in new tech products where you know, there's that kernel of critique about the existing institution. And I love that you're addressing that, you're diving into that, you're being quite fearless about it, I would say. So kudos to you and the team for that. So yeah, the lightning round is just, you know, a few quick questions where we ask you for like crisp, short answers to, and it's a chance for our audience to get to know you a little bit better as an individual. You've already shared a ton, so this will pale in comparison to your origin story, but super curious to hear, what is a game-changing tech product in your life?
I would say internet.
Okay. That works.
I know. I'm very old. And the reason I'm saying that is everything else, like when I think about most of the products that have come out, they are small step, like in terms of a consumer experience, it's like a small step, a small nudge. I mean, like I could say smartphones, for example, right? That has been, but was it game changing? Would I have not been able to get where I am? I wouldn't say no. But when I think about game changing, I'm like, if someone takes away all my gadgets and all of these things, at what point would my life stop being my life? And I believe if someone takes away internet, that's it. And if you think about it, internet is the way some countries control the entire continent, right? So this is—
and we're seeing it in like protest movements and things like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's also like a particularly like millennial answer, because I think many of us remember the world before the internet, which I can't even imagine. Like Gen Z must think we're just absolutely ancient at this point, but like we remember it. You know, we went outside, we played, we didn't quite have the internet, you know, and I'm speaking broad strokes here, but then we did.
But that's what it was, right? And that is what changed life for me. And maybe because I had to have the slow life before the fast life, I have adopted. So I know if like, oh, if electricity goes off, like my son, right? He's four. He was four when he asked, if electricity goes away, what are we going to do? I'm like, well, we're going to light a fire. And he's like, what? Can we do that? Yes, you could. So I can imagine. Of course, if you ask the same question from my parents, they might give a different answer. But the thing that has changed my life and the thing that keeps changing my life and powers everything in my life is internet. That's the bit that if it goes away, things will start falling apart for me. If you take it on your smartphone, it's fine. I have other things to do. I can do other ways.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a job, wouldn't have a company. So yeah, definitely agree with you on that. Great segue to the next question. What's a problem that tech can't solve for us and why?
It's a very, very good question. Because as I said, it's because of my view about tech being a tool. And I think that the bit that tech cannot solve for us is us being human, us being compassionate, and us acknowledging life is short and try to enjoy it together. That is something that is truly human. Tech can facilitate it. Tech can help us do it. Like, you know, we can call our parents if they're far away. We can hop on an airplane and go and do things. But at the end of the day, that emotion inside us, that's very human. And I think that is something that tech can bring us to that doorstep, but we are the ones who need to lift our foot and cross it. Yeah, human connection.
That ends up being like a frequent answer that we get for that question. And I think, yeah, your point about tech facilitating it is a good one, that we keep running into that. So thank you for that. On the flip side of that, what's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Oh my gosh, that is a very, very, very long list.
What's the one that like jumps to your head immediately when you think about evil tech?
I have a few in my head. I just don't know like if I should put it out there or not.
Give it to her.
I will say it's TikTok.
Oh, interesting. Okay. We get a lot of Facebook. I don't think we've had TikTok yet. Tell us why.
It's a tool that is used wrongly. And as I said, it's like, it's not that it's an evil tech, but it's used evilly. It's very addictive. It actually messes up brain. It damages attention span. It's damaging. It's something that actually is not produced. It's like, how can I say it? It's like drugs. It's like drugs that you just hook onto and then you detach from reality of life, because it's such a high, fast pace kind of thing. It starts seeping into the unconscious. And if you know a little bit about brain, if we thought Facebook has done damage, wait till you see what TikTok will do. Forget about all the things, the data they steal and all of those stuff that they do, the evil things they do, that aside, but just the technology itself, if they were willing to use it for good, it could be very powerful. It could do lots of good things, but right now it's brazen. Is out there just living a wild life, and it is destroying a lot. I forbid my daughter to be on TikTok. So she's allowed to be on Facebook, but not TikTok.
That's a powerful, I mean, given some of your background, that's a powerful sort of claim. And yeah, I mean, well backed up, I'm sure, by the science. And it's given us a good idea to like maybe do an episode of the podcast on sort of brain development, TikToks. I think that's just like a fascinating topic. And again, like setting aside the security and privacy stuff to just focus on how it's influencing us. So
yeah, just as a technology, because as I said, like a knife, this is knife in the hands of murderers. If you could put it in the hand of a surgeon, it could do good.
on the flip side of that, if you, other setting aside Alina for a second, if you could develop, you know, a new tech product, what problem would it solve and for whom?
I don't know, because all the kinds of things that the dreams I have for Alina, for example, right now, social anxiety is our very first product. It is kind of like embedded in the roadmap that I'm dreaming for Alina. Eventually, what I wish to have is a system, an algorithm that connects people in the virtual world and advocates for them and helps them. You see, even though internet has bridged a lot of geographic distances, like look at us right now, right? We're not even in the same room having this amazing pleasant conversation. Yeah, we have bridged a lot of gaps, but still, if you're not born in the right family, right country, right time, right network, right money, your chances of surviving into fulfilling who you are is pretty slim. My dream is, and my hope is for Alina, these are all steps we are taking towards that dream, that one day Alina understands people well enough that it becomes their advocate. So they can use Alina as a tool to bridge all of those things when it comes to networking. Like, you know, it puts them in touch, different Alinas put them in touch with each other because it understands, or at least has some sense of understanding what these people need.
That's powerful. I like the subtext that you've kind of threaded it throughout of your talk about Alina, but like unlocking folks' potential, you know, seeing them for who they are, helping them unlock their own potential, I should say. You know, like I love that sort of subtext with throughout everything you've mentioned about Alina. So that's really powerful. Last question is just around, you know, and we kind of talked about this a bit, but in the tech for good space, we're always juggling, okay, how do I balance profit and purpose? You know, I want to do good for the world and help people, but still need to raise money, still need to provide food for my family and keep the lights on. And sometimes that means, you know, accommodating what investors want and things like that, and users, what they're willing to buy. So how have you navigated those sort of tensions, those polarities in your life?
I have to say, I know at some point we will possibly face to make that kind of calls. But so far, as I said, we've been very lucky. We've been in high demands when it was coming to investments. So from investor part, so the users and the investors, right? So from the investor side, not all investors are evil. There are some investors who believe in impact. They believe in like, I made my money. Now I want to do good somewhere, right? So these impact investors are the kind that we're looking for. And usually what happens there, we are culturally aligned. And when there is this cultural alignment, they give a lot of, and we vet them. It's like a dating kind of thing, right? So for us, it matters that when they come on board, they really understand who we are. And when we sign term sheets and everything like that, that they understand that they're signing into a culture, not just a product. Because Alina as a vision is not just a product. So far it has worked. We have our investors, whether they're angels or VCs or organizations or whatever, they are fully behind us. They share our vision and they believe in what we're doing. So we haven't had any push or problem from their side. When it comes to users, because we are extremely user-centric, we try to build something that truly makes a difference in their life, not something that makes them happy. You know, we're not building to keep users at all costs. We are building for users to change their lives. And when they see the impact in their life, they listen to us. They allow us to be in the driver's seat because we are now here, the authority that can help us shine light on the path they want to walk. So in that way, when they trust us, they will give us freedom to help them become better. So far, it has been that way, and I hope it stays that way, but we'll see.
That's great. That's such a powerful sort of reframe of like the power relationship, you know, that often exists between funders and startups, and just saying, hey, this is like dating. We're assessing each other here rather than the one way, the typical framing that we have of that relationship where startup leaders are, you know, they're supplicants, they're begging for funding so that they can survive and breathe. And yeah, appreciate you saying that. Well, this has been a great conversation, Mandana, co-founder and CEO at Alina. We so appreciate your time today. And I think I think our audience is going to love this chat, you know, about all things digital health and tech. Where can folks find more about you and Alina on the internet?
Thank you so much, Paul. It was a pleasure talking to you and I really enjoyed this chat. And if there's any questions anybody from the audience has, I'm always reachable. I am there because I want to hear from people. So reach out to me.
Cool. And if folks want to find more information about Alina, is it just alina.com or what's the best way to?
Alina.com, A-L-E-N-A.com.
We'll include that in the show description. And yeah, folks, check out Alina. Hopefully you can join as a co-creator and support the development of Alina as they move forward.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you so much, Mandana. Have a good one.